talking with Ken Thomas, a researcher and author, who does some pretty good investigating, in fact, some very good investigating pieces on different conspiracies. You know, Ken, I'm not even sure it's the government itself. I mean, purely the government. It seems to me that these corporations, they got a lot to lose, and they'd be involved, and they probably would be pretty vicious.
Well, that really was the lesson of the octopus, the idea of the octopus, that there are these transnational corporate presences who all have kind of interlocking police agencies working for them. Without getting into too much detail, this involves Wackenhut, and but also the CIA, the Mossad, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. All of these people illegally bought this promise software. That's the chunk of the story that I left out. This Earl Blind guy was given this promise software, which was a surveillance software, to sell around the world illegally because it didn't belong to him. That was his payoff for making the drop to Khomeini, for the money that was gave to Khomeini to hold on to the hostages. So, yeah, when you say the government, what government are you talking about? You know, the elected government, the political government that we have, that we, you know, that we go through these election cycles every 4 or 8 years to put people in there, supposedly that are supported by, you know, some large group of citizens, or is it the parapolitical government, you know, the ones that have corporate executives who are put there because they've been able to meet their ambitions up with, you know, the right people and able to pull strings and make sure certain governments topple, certain people die, that kind of thing.
What book are you working on now?
Well, the book that I have out now is called Secret and Suppressed 2, Banned Ideas and Hidden History into the 21st Century. And that is, it's a collection of different conspiracy articles, different people. My contribution to it is actually goes a little further into the roots of the military-industrial complex. Mine is about Wilhelm Reich and his connection to Dwight Eisenhower and Eisenhower and all the stories about Eisenhower meeting with aliens and how this is all part of
this. This Eisenhower and E.T. meeting thing, I mean, there's lots of stories out there. We've done lots of shows on it, have lots of documentation. Seems to me that something might have happened, maybe at Edwards. No, Ken, there seems to be a lot of evidence that in the 1950s we had had some sort of little war going on with these UFOs.
Yeah, well, that's the idea.
Why?
The aliens were kind of attracted to the atomic testing. You know, that the whole war ended.
And there's a lot of evidence that some of these high-powered radars that people suspect caused some of these UFO crashes back there in New Mexico.
Yeah.
Actually, they were done on purpose.
Yeah.
Have you heard about that? Have you heard that?
No, I have. I know that sometimes the some researchers refer to the Maury Island incident and the Bannister UFO as radar fogging devices of some sort. But yeah,
let's get back to your situation, the Maury Island UFO incident.
No, it's kind of lost to history. I mean, Arnold talks about it in Coming of the Saucers. He says the stuff looked a lot like, you know, regular.
Do you have any idea what that stuff was dripping from the saucer, the black and the white stuff, the silver stuff?
But it was liquid originally.
Well, the white stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have a wobbling flying saucer, and what happens in the incident is that it's wobbling, and that's why all that crap is coming off of it. Then one of the other circling saucers taps it, touches it, and it straightens up, and then they all fly away. One researcher suggested to me, in fact, that those saucers, 3 days later, maybe that's what Kenneth Arnold saw in that formation. And then the following month, maybe that wobbling flying saucer wasn't repaired as well as they thought it was, and it crashed in Roswell. This is the unified saucer theory of what was going on in 47.
You know, the naysayers to extraterrestrial life coming here, they say this was a Nazi thing, the thing we'd recovered from the Nazis.
Well, yeah, the Nazis were developing saucer-shaped craft at the end of the war.
Well, I'm kind of leaning toward the extraterrestrial theory myself. But,
yeah, well, I know people, John Judge particularly, who's a famous JFK researcher, just will have none of the UFO extraterrestrial stuff. He says it's all Nazis.
Yeah.
So Fred Crispin goes to work for Boeing. There's a Boeing General Dynamics battle over the race to the moon with Kennedy, and it all came forward on the development of that fighter. Do you subscribe to the idea that there's a lot of technology out there, black operations that are way beyond our wildest dreams?
Oh, I'm certain of that. You got to hope, you know. You got to hope that the Pentagon.
But I wonder why they keep it secret now.
Well, they parcel it out. I have news clippings in my files here that show that, you know, they developed the hydrogen fuel cell in 1947, too.
Technically speaking, 1947 was a very good year.
Yeah, well, the thing is, the idea is that this stuff is hard to decode, you know, that we've recovered some things and we're trying to understand it. One of the interesting things about the MJ-12 business is that one of the members of MJ-12 is a guy named Vannevar Bush, who was a scientific advisor.
Yeah, I've heard that name many times.
Yeah, well, he's known well amongst computer people for an essay he wrote called As We May Think, in which he, and it's written right at the time of the Roswell assassination, and before there are any computers, and he's writing about kind of like a Rube Goldberg desk that has microfilm and microfiche, and saying that, you know, pointing out that the sum of human knowledge has gotten to be so much and so complex that we have to create this kind of new technology that we can manage it better. He's basically describing personal computers that eventually, you know, we all started to use after a while. So, you know, there's even the thought that the PCs that we use is back-engineered Roswell technology from aliens.
I go along with that pretty much about Roswell. In fact, I think, you know, we turned over so much stuff to corporations to back-engineer and develop and et cetera, and they got patents and just a lot of business interests tied up in this now, more than really the government's interest. Of course, they're kind of the same. A good corporate lawyer would advise, don't disclose. I mean, some guy's going to get together a bunch of people and file a class action suit, and you never know, some of these liberal judges, they'll allow them to give our profits away to the government. I mean, that would pay for health care alone.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we live in an environment where it's only part secret. I mean, anybody who pays attention to it realizes that there's something real going on here.
Yeah.
So it's kind of out in public. But, you know, if you try to push in any kind of, you know, serious, solid legal direction, it vanishes and it disappears, or it gets difficult for anybody to claim responsibility for it.
That was Ken Thomas. Since we mentioned UFOs in this show, I thought we'd close our conspiracy hour this week with a UFO conspiracy. Efforts to keep quiet that we're actually being visited by visitors from other worlds. So listen to this. The Cisco Grove encounter. It happened in September of 1964. Donald Schramm was hunting in the mountains near Cisco Grove in California, located near the Nevada border. Schramm was hunting with a bow and arrow. It was before the gun season opened. He had two buddies with him. Both of them, as well as Schramm, worked at the Aerojet Corporation in Sacramento. As it got dark, Schramm was separated from the other two, and early in the evening, he saw a strange light that turned out to be a spaceship. It was a large one, estimated between 140 and 150 feet wide. It had three doors. They slid open. Here is how Schramm explains why he was where he was when this event happened.
Well, we were getting ready for the evening hunt, and I went down the one ridge, and this one friend of mine went down the canyon bottom, and the other went down the other ridge. And when we got to the end of the ridge, it was just a sheer drop-off where I was, so I had to backtrack and go down and around the other side of the ridge. And by the time I got to the bottom, it was pitch black. And so I stumbled through the brush. I couldn't see nothing. It was just dark. You know, before the moon comes up, it gets really dark in the mountains. And I crashed through the brush and stuff, and then I could see the moon was starting up, and I saw the big granite cliff with a crack that went up the side, and the crack was about a foot wide, so I was able to walk up there, and there was a tree right at the edge when I got up there, so I figured there's a lot of bear in the area, so I figured I'd spend the night in the tree. The base of the tree to the first limb was about 12 feet, but from the rock it was only about 7 feet. I could reach up and hand walk out to the trunk of the tree and then pull myself up. Anyway, there was two limbs come out on an angle, and then there was one that I sit on, and then I put my foot on the other one. And so I was figuring on spending the night up there. And then I saw a light. It looked like a lantern going up and down a trail. But then it came over the top of the tree. And I got kind of excited then because I thought it was a helicopter from the Forest Service. I stood between two of the fires that I built on the rocks and waved my arms and yelled and screamed and finally that light started coming towards me, so I was really relieved then because I thought it was a helicopter still, until it got within maybe 60 feet or yards, I'm not sure the distance at night, but it just stood hovered there with no sound. So then I panicked because I knew it was no helicopter. And then I saw three panels of light, like windows or whatever. And I saw a flash come from the bottom of the center one, and just saw a dark object go down to in the canyon, and then I lost track of it. And then the next thing I saw was a little blinking light up on the top of originally where the first one came from. But then I saw when it landed up on the ridge that it I could see like a half. I could only see part of the top, but it had a little light on it, and looked like the top of a flying saucer that I'd seen in pictures.
Schwamm saw three figures come out. Two were humanoid, and one was robotic. Looked like something out of a movie.
No, it was just a kind of a dark shadow. I could see the two like eyes that were... looked like welding goggles to me. It was the same as welding goggles. And then the rest of the face was kind of a blur. I couldn't see looking down at him. Come down up on the rock. He was about 7 feet from me. And then he touched his mouth and kind of a steam vapor come out of his mouth, and it lit up his face so I could see some detail. And then I blacked out when that steam hit me, or I guess it was kind of took the air from me, and I'd gasp for air and then black out, and I fell over my boat. And that's the only thing that kept me in the tree. And then, so I figured they were out to get me then.
Donald Schwamm managed to evade them all night by climbing up to the top of the tree. And he passed out. He had a belt around the tree. He woke up in the morning. They were gone. An encounter that he never talked about for years. He worked for a defense contractor in Sacramento. That's our show for tonight. Thanks for listening. I'm Jerry Pippin.